Second case for oral argument this morning is Sally Richardson Appellant versus Michael Richardson Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Robert Pascalucci, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Nathaniel Forrest Nelson, an attorney also from Rapid City. Mr. Pascalucci, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court. South Dakota remains one of the few states that has yet to allow spouses or former spouses to seek relief for the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress incurred during the course of marriage and for which distress leads to the divorce. My brief and the court synopsis sets forth the statement of facts in this case, but succinctly stated, Sally Richardson's complaint alleges Michael Richardson, during the time that the parties were married, forced Sally to act as a sex worker slash escort against her will, physical and emotional violence inflicted upon her, as well as forcing her against her will to commit demeaning sex acts upon him. As a result of Michael's extreme and outrageous conduct, throughout the course of the party's marriage, Sally suffers to this day from the effects of severe emotional distress, to include PTSD. The trial court dismissed Sally's complaint for failure to state a claim upon which relief could be granted, finding that the holding in the case of Pickering v. Pickering was applicable to Sally's case, concluding that the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress is unavailable as a matter of public policy when it is predicated on the conduct that leads to the dissolution of marriage. I submit to the court that the time has come to completely revoke the concept of interspousal immunity and allow spouses and former spouses the same right to seek relief as others, as other similarly situated unmarried persons.
Why would not this be the prerogative of the legislature rather than this court?
Because the court has completely addressed this as a matter of public policy ever since Scoville. They have done that through a lineage of cases repeatedly, and they have addressed the public policy, and they are the ones that seem to have set the concerns that deal with the public policy in matters such as this.
And what would that public policy entail, Mr. Pascalucci? What are you proposing?
Well, as far as it goes towards the public policy, the court in the Illinois Supreme Court in Feltmire v. Feltmire addressed a lot of these concerns, as have the majority of other states that do allow cases for IIED for conduct that occurs during the marriage, intentional infliction of emotional distress during the marriage. Many other of the other states say it doesn't matter if you're married or unmarried to bring these cases. We're not going to make that distinction. And the public policies that are addressed in this and as have been addressed otherwise in cases like Christensen and Kluge, is it seems a lot of what South Dakota Supreme Court case rulings have focused on is one, marital harmony, but in these kind of cases, the harmony is gone. It's already long gone. Secondly, the public policy of, well, how are the courts going to deal with supposed floodgate of litigation that could occur? That does not happen. It has not happened in the majority of the other states that have gone to the place that I'm asking you to go today. That is because we trust our trial court justices to sift through the cases and find those that have merit and don't. We also have Rule 11 sanctions that we can bring against attorneys for bringing frivolous cases. We also have the summary judgment. We do have the right to dismiss case for failure to state a claim. The public policy concerns that we have today, those are the concerns of the old. The policy concerns we have to look to today Are we going to give a free pass to someone that beats their spouse, that makes them do things that they shouldn't do just because they're married? We should not do that. Everybody deserves their day in court. By not allowing the court, a person such as Sally, to have their day in court, precludes justice. The courts are in the business of justice, and they deserve to be heard. So that is the public policy concerns I think we're facing here today, especially given the case that we have with Sally, where she's forced to do these things, to say that Michael Richardson gets a free pass for making his wife do what is alleged is terrible. We have taken a stand over the course of the last 10 years in recognizing that human trafficking is a problem in our society. And the mere fact that because Sally was married, when she did not want to do these things, when she was forced to do these things against her will, when she had other acts done upon her, to say that, "I'm sorry, Sally, you were married at that time, you do not get your day in court." So I think that's the new public policy that we're looking at. Further, the court has already opened the door repeatedly for this to kind of swing fully open, starting with Scovold, of course, in 1941, but then continuing through the progeny of cases that we have after that point in time. The courts start to recognize that you can have an independent tort action and sue your spouse during the course of your marriage, which is an interesting distinction. And I'm going to come back to that. That has been found. And interestingly, in Henry, in Gassman, the court said, "We recognize this right, you can go ahead and sue." In Henry, the court said, "If only you had had a waiver, if only you hadn't assigned a waiver to keep you from suing after the divorce, you could have gone ahead." That's kind of how Henry reads. So in this case here with Sally, because the law is somewhat mixed on this, Sally did sign a waiver. Sally signed a waiver saying, "I preserve the right to pursue any other course of action that I have following this divorce." Now, I don't necessarily know that that needs to happen in cases such as this, because, one, there's a lot of reasons that people want out of a divorce, or they're not thinking at that time clearly because they're under duress. But she did sign a waiver. I submit in the future maybe they shouldn't have to sign waivers for that. But Justice Konenkamp in Henry said, "I join the court in recognizing the tort action of infliction and intentional infliction of emotional distress during the course of a marriage." And it's during that case that he talked about all these other things that the courts need to be aware of. But I submit the vast majority of the cases that this court has dealt with deal with affairs of the heart, illegitimate children, and the kind of things that unfortunately today maybe have become a bit common within our society. But those things don't raise to the criteria, which is a very high criteria you have to meet for intentional infliction of emotional distress. The conduct, the behavior has to be both extreme and outrageous. It's not good enough for it to be extreme. It's not good enough to be outrageous. It has to be both of those. And that, I submit clearly, as Justice Kaczynski noted when he made his ruling on this matter, that if what is alleged is true, it's despicable, it is outrageous, and basically was a terrible thing to happen. But he felt compelled, because of Pickering, to to dismiss that claim. Those Pickering is not in any way analogous to this case, excepting the fact that there was a course of conduct during the marriage that led to this. The appellee would like to argue in his case that we don't need to overturn Pickering. He makes some statements that Sally, during the course of the divorce, could have filed for divorce under the provisions of extreme cruelty. But how does that compensate her for what he put her through? This court has said, again, in this lineage of cases, and this is an important distinction, I think, that a tort action does not have a place within a divorce action. That is key. If it doesn't have a place within a divorce action, where does it have a place? Has a place outside the divorce action. Okay. Additionally, filing under extreme cruelty, again, does not compensate her. He says, well, you know, she could have got a protection order. That doesn't help her. Maybe some would say she could have gotten alimony, but given the short period of marriage that they had, that's doubtful. And also, alimony is prospective. It looks to going forward to help somebody go forward on that. It does not compensate for the harm that has been done in the past.
Well, rehabilitative alimony does, doesn't it?
Well, it may have some bearing in rehabilitative alimony to provide some compensation, but how does it compensate on a level for the harm committed? If you're in a car accident and you're hurt, you get rehabilitation and through the doctors and PT, you get money for that to pay those kind of costs. But you also get compensation for enduring the physical harm that you've endured. Plus, how long is the rehabilitation alimony going to go? That is typically very short. So I don't think that is the answer either. And in Gossman, however it's said, they were married for 2 years, and the court did not award alimony in that case either. So,
well, now, you know, one thing that hasn't come up yet, your client could sue for a different tort for the same conduct. It's only intentional infliction that's barred by Pickering.
Well,
I mean, the conduct you're alleging, some of it would certainly qualify. According to the allegations, it would qualify as an assault.
It would qualify as an assault, and
so compensation would be available if you sued out that tort.
I think actually, if sustained, yes. But again, some of these cases, in the progeny that we have up to today, there were physical assaults in there as well. And again, if it's conduct that's predicate upon something leading to the divorce, then it seems to be precluded as well.
There's no dispute about that in this case, is there, that this was conduct leading to the divorce?
Well, actually, I think it's very interesting to note that my client is not the one that filed for the divorce. Mr. Richardson filed for the divorce.
But, I mean, you've treated this claim as if that's the case.
We did treat that claim as if it's the case. But there are, and there is information in the briefs that say that it's not the entirety of what led to the divorce. But even if it had, when you take someone and you basically tell them, I mean, again, we're looking at two separate actions, and the divorce and the tort. And the court has said that the tort needs to be tried outside of the divorce. So that is what we're doing here. And to say, again, when you take a look at the harm that's inflicted upon somebody such as my client has endured, it is a physical, it's a mental tort, and it is very incapacitating to her to this day. And that is, the physical part of it is a small part. I submit, much like many victims that suffer trauma, the trauma is gone, but the mental harm lingers.
What about the remedy of suing during the divorce if the conduct is sufficiently outrageous and extreme? You'd still have your claim before the divorce.
And Justice, I had thought of that as well. And to me, that, again, if she can sue, or he, whoever the case may be able to sue during the course of the marriage and get damages, you're saying the only difference here is the fact that they're married. And similarly situated unmarried persons likewise can sue at any time, but we're saying if you're married, if you want to recover on that tort, go ahead and stay married, but you can sue for that tort. I submit, why does it really matter what comes first? It really shouldn't. Either we have a tort action or we don't. And again, the courts are places where justice needs to occur. And we should not preclude justice because of the basis that someone is married to someone else. And that is why I submit the majority of the other states in the nation have done away with their cases such as Pickering, where they say it doesn't matter. You're not going to get a free pass. You know, we're going to go ahead, we'll get the divorce done. If we take a tort and we sue it during the course of the marriage and it's that severe and outrageous, well, then we're forcing the person that's suing to stay tied in a relationship they probably don't want to be in for perhaps several years. So even if the tort's concluded, then at that point in time, we're going to have to go through a divorce action. You know. So I actually think this makes more sense, especially because of additional mental problems and other logistical problems that could develop. If they want to sue after the divorce, they should be allowed to do so. It, as I kind of alluded before, as this court stated in Henry 1 and reemphasized in Christian, in addition to compensatory damages, which a person should be entitled to, punitive damages can also be considered. Punitive damages are awarded for the purpose of deterring the person against whom they are awarded from repeating the offense and others from committing it. In Henry 1, the court recognized, quoting a West Virginia case, "Of significance is the right for persons to recover for the intentional tort."
2 minutes.
Our law before us today practiced the cruel paradox. Under the guise of promoting family harmony, it permitted the wife beater to practice his twisted frustrations, secure in the knowledge he was immune from civil action except for a divorce, and that any criminal penalty would ordinarily be a modest fine if nothing else. The knowledge of a monetary judgment with punitive damages may stay such violence. Unfortunately, in today's society, many cases, such as discussed previously about affairs of the heart and those kind of things, do not rise to extreme and outrageous conduct. Those offenses do not have a place for relief under intentional infliction. But when spouses are routinely beat, degraded, and forced to participate in acts which go against their will, there must be more relief than just a divorce decree, and a grieved person should be entitled to pursue that relief whether or not they are married at the time of those actions. Pickering should not hold Michael Richardson immune for his actions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pascalucci. Mr. Nelson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm honored to be here for my first ever Supreme Court argument, and I want to thank you for this privilege. What Mr. Pascalucci is asking today is that this court change existing law. He's essentially asking this court to do a job that's better suited for the legislature. The democratically elected legislator is perfectly capable of writing new law, is perfectly capable of abrogating new law, as evidenced by South Dakota Statute 3511-1, in which the legislature references the case of Waltz v. the City of Hudson, and asked that the court's ruling in that case be abrogated into state law. And again, South Dakota Codified Law 20-9-1.1, citing Jorgensen v. Venner, a 2002 case.
What about the argument that Mr. Pascalucci made that this was a court-created ruling primarily out of Pickering in the mid, or I guess late 1980s?
My response to that, Your Honor, would be that silence on behalf of the legislature is agreement. If the legislature really wanted to change this, this law is no new novel idea. This policy has been in place since the 80s, and if the legislature had the desire to change that, they've had 20-plus years to do that.
Pickering is a highly fractured decision. Do you not think it's time to revisit the public policy expression made by this court in Pickering?
I do not think that's the case, Your Honor. And specifically because, like you said, it's highly fractured, there's only one minor instance in which a spouse cannot sue a spouse, and that's when it's based off of a conduct predicated on the dissolution of a marriage.
Isn't that rule so broad that it would encompass nearly all harm within the marriage?
And another aspect, Your Honor, is somebody could argue that, but in every case, it specifically states, every case in the Pickering progeny specifically states that not every wrong has a right. And unfortunately, disregard of feelings, depraved actions, and multiple different wrongs just don't have a right. And the court's job is to try to right as many wrongs as possible, but sometimes there is just no right that can be had by this criminal justice system. But on that point, I would like to note that Mr. Pascalucci is arguing that there is no remedies for Mrs. Richardson, which is simply just not the case. There's multiple remedies. And what he's asking to do is essentially get two bites at the apple. He's asking for the remedy that's in divorce to be expanded past the divorce proceedings into a tort action. But on top of that, based off of what they're alleging Michael Richardson did, there's also a criminal remedy. And as Mr. Pascalucci specifically stated in the transcript from the trial court motions hearing, Judge Kaczynski specifically asked, well, have the authorities been notified? This is sounds like some horrible acts that have happened. And Mr. Pascalucci stated, yes, the authorities had been notified. An investigation had been done, and that there was only charges that were ever brought out of all these allegations were charges solely against Sally for prostitution. There's nothing brought against Mr. Richardson. So that's one remedy. She had that remedy. Didn't work out. She had the remedy in the divorce action. She specifically could have stated, South Dakota is a fault state divorce. She could have stated in her answer that it was intentional infliction of emotional distress or extreme cruelty or habitual intemperance, but she didn't. She settled the case. She lost that opportunity. She waived it right there for a settlement that she got out of the divorce. And now what they're asking this court to do is allow a second bite at the apple, a matter that could have been brought up in the divorce court. They waived that, and now they got a settlement out of that, and now they're coming back again trying to ask for another opportunity to get more money out of Michael Richardson.
But she couldn't ask for an award of damages within the context of a divorce, ordinarily tort damages, could she?
No, she could not have asked for that, but...
So what good is it?
There's, again, we discussed, or Mr. Pascalucci had discussed the rehabilitative alimony, and since there is a fault-based requirement in South Dakota, unless the parties consent to irreconcilable differences, then there's an opportunity for a judge to grant a remedy through the fault of the divorce. And I'd like to go on to just state how this court has referenced multiple times in other cases cited in my brief, specifically Sanford v. Sanford, which is a South Dakota case that also cites Veter v. Kennedy, that this court states, we are not legislative overlords empowered to eliminate laws whenever we surmise they are no longer relevant or necessary. And I'd also like to reference the fact that the case that Mr. Pascalucci referenced, Fetmier v. Fetmier, the Illinois case, where he would state that the public policy from that case should be adopted into South Dakota, is an inaccurate statement from my understanding, because Fetmier v. Fetmier is not a public policy-based case. It's based on statute. And the main case that he's relying on is a case that was decided by the legislature, not the Supreme Court in Illinois. And further on, I'd just like to hit on the point that this court has also stated in the case of, and again, I'm going to butcher the name of this case, but I believe it's pronounced Urine Chiropractic Clinic v. DeSmit. Although the court stated, this is a quotation, although we acknowledge that competing public policy considerations have been articulated by foreign courts adopting opposing views, we leave it to the legislature to balance competing public policies. And Mr. Pascalucci's entire argument is based off of case law and statutes from foreign jurisdictions, competing public policies. And this court has specifically stated when there is an instance like that, that it's to be up to the legislature to decide and not the court.
Do you agree with Mr. Pascalucci's assessment that the majority of jurisdictions have abandoned interspousal tort immunity?
I do. I do believe that, Your Honor. And the best response I can have to that is it's not always the best decision to keep up with the Joneses. Just because your neighbor's doing it doesn't mean it's right for this state. South Dakota is a completely different jurisdiction, completely different laws. And the fact that if South Dakota was the only jurisdiction that hadn't adopted this would be a different argument. But there's still many jurisdictions that have not adopted this, including California with the Richards P. case. That case specifically states that it just opens the door for all kinds of problems by allowing tort actions from actions that led to the dissolution of a marriage. And Justice Konenkamp specifically had some very good quotes from some case law in the Fluke case from 2004 that we hold that to recover for a claim of intentional infliction of emotional distress, the claimant must establish the necessary elements of the tort separate from the grounds of divorce. And this reason is to ensure that these tort claims are not conceived out of petty spite or as leverage for concessions on a divorce issue. And Justice Konenkamp hit on an issue right there where he's concerned about the floodgates being opened. And once we allow this tort action possible, then there's just a plethora of different scenarios that could happen that would be quite detrimental to the court system. It could be flooded with just about every single divorce action has some grounds for hurt feelings, some grounds for some possible tort, whether or not it's based in truth, it still opens the door for an opportunity for these torts to be brought into the court system. And as Justice Konenkamp specifically stated, it can be used as leverage in the divorce proceedings. If you don't concede to give me $30,000 for our six-month marriage, I'm going to file an intentional infliction of emotional distress tort after this divorce is done. And it just opens the door for too many problems that this court has already thought of that this court doesn't want to allow. And I just can't hit home on how many times this court has ruled against this change. This isn't a novel idea. This isn't the first time this court has had this request. In 1989, Pickering set the precedent. But in 1995, there was Henry. 2000, there was Henry II. 2001, Christians. And 2007, State v. Harbert. And Harbert was decided a whole 4 years after the non-binding case that Mr. Pascalucci referenced, Fetmier, which essentially, to me, states that not only did this court have 4 years to contemplate that ruling in Fetmir, but the legislature also had 4 years. And once that case was decided 4 years later, then we had the same request brought up in State Farm v. Harbert, and this court decided to decline the ruling out of Fetmir. And since then, the legislature has had 9 years to decide, to listen to that, to contemplate that ruling in Fetmir and decide whether or not to change the law, and they haven't done so. This is just not a novel idea, and this court and the legislature have both declined to do that for good reason. Another point that I think is extremely important to reference is that this case isn't about spouses not being able to sue spouses. As Mr. Pascalucci referenced, the Gassman case, the Scoville case, spouses can sue spouses. It's just the one specific instance where it's a suit based off of acts that were predicated on the dissolution of the marriage. And that's what a divorce proceeding is for, and that's what this court has decided, that when there's specific acts committed that could rise to the level of a tort that caused the divorce to happen, it's to muddling the boundaries between the two different types of suits, and it's better suited to just leave it in the marriage and the divorce proceeding and allow the court to decide it in that matter. Otherwise, res judicata kicks in. Otherwise, as Justice Konenkamp referenced, the door is open and somebody gets two bites at the apple. And that's essentially what Mr. Pascalucci and Sally Richardson are asking today, is to get a second bite at the apple when they lost their opportunity. And furthermore, I would like to note that Mr. Pascalucci brought up the issue of waiver, was not briefed at all in his brief. Therefore, this court's decision should not be bound by anything to do with waiver. As well as, I'd like to bring up an issue that I brought up in my notice of review, which is the Rule 56 summary judgment request. In that request, I'm not disagreeing with what the circuit court decided. I think Judge Kaczynski hit it spot on, that this case should not proceed because they failed to state a claim upon which relief may be granted. And the Rule 12b-5 ruling was correct. However, if in the off reason that this court does decide that they're going to do the legislature's job today and change the law, I would just request this court to consider my notice of review and grant the Rule 56 ruling. And based off the fact that Mr. Pascalucci didn't respond to any of that request in my brief, there's multiple case law in South Dakota stating that failure to brief a matter is waiver. So essentially, they're agreeing that this court should grant the Rule 56 summary judgment if you do decide to rule in favor of Mr. Pascalucci's request. Walburn Living Trust is one case. Spencer v. City of Sioux Falls is another case. State v. Blackburn is spot on. That specifically states failure to comply with the notice of review equals a waiver. So I don't think there's any contention that if for whatever reason, I don't think that this would be the wise decision, but if the court does decide to do that and grant Mr. Pascalucci's request, I just ask this court to please adhere with my request in the notice of review and grant this Rule 56 motion.
Okay. You have completed?
I am complete, Your Honor.
Well, since this is your first time, I'll tell you no one has ever criticized for quitting early.
What was that?
No one has ever criticized for quitting early.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Pascalucci, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just a couple of additional comments in conclusion. Back in 1981, in Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court there stated, "We reject the opportunity present of these facts to engraft exceptions onto an outmoded, unwarranted doctrine that denies a litigant, because of marital status and relationship, the opportunity to prove his or her claim in court. Instead, we conclude that a tortfeasor's immunity from liability because of their marital relationship with the injured party cannot be sustained on the basis of law, logic, or public policy. Sally's.
Mr. Pasqualucci, what about the, you dismissed the notion that there was a remedy in the divorce action, but could you revisit the issue of that there is a remedy? Fault is not an issue in property division, but it is in alimony. And could not that have been addressed in the action for divorce? So is she totally out of, or someone in her position, totally out of a remedy, because it can be addressed with fault as an issue in the divorce action?
It is the belief that alimony would not have been an adequate compensation for what she's gone through. Alimony can go towards, as the court well knows, towards the property settlement, as Chief Justice Gilbertson referenced, some rehabilitative alimony. But again, we have to look. That is not adequate compensation for the harm that has been done. And many times in these instances, it's not going to be available or it's not going to be suitable. And again, they have two separate purposes. Tort actions compensate for damages. And additionally, when you add the punitive piece, and I dare say in additional cases such as this, the public policy argument that is out there that if you do these kind of things, if you do these torts, then it works to not only punish the person for the civil wrong, but it also should act as a deterrent and notice to others that may do so as well. So I do not believe, based on the facts at hand and the previous cases that we read, that alimony would be sufficient remedy in this case. And Sally's intentional infliction of emotional distress was not done from inflicted upon her by mere words. It was not done from petty squabbles and hurt feelings. It was done from actual physical and psychological abuse, abuse that should not keep an injured spouse from seeking relief, and abuse that doesn't give an abuser a pass just because of conduct that occurred during the course of a marriage. Thank you for your time on Sally's behalf, and unless there are any further questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Pasqualucci.
Thank you.
We run on the hour, so the court will be in recess until 11 o'clock, and we'll hear our third case.